afternoon.
I'm trying to train myself from stop saying good morning. I have been on in the morning for a long time, and I just, it's always good morning. Anyway, you're listening to the second hour of We the People Radio. I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And when one of us is missing, everything goes, you know, it's just not,
sideways,
it's just not good.
Yeah.
Requires all three of us to make it happen. So we are in the throes of discussing a book called It's All About Muhammad, A Biography of the World's Most Notorious Prophet. And I think in light of what's going on in the world today, the author Frank Burley has a tremendous amount of light to shed on current events. How about that? We'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
All right, boys, pick it up where we left off.
We were talking about Muhammad. He's in Mecca. He's approximately, I don't know, 35, 40 years old now. And he's been, now he's convinced that he was touched by an angel in one of his epileptic seizures, which I think is important to know because that was one of the things that, in fact, Aaron had a conversation last week with somebody who was a supposed expert on Muhammad, didn't know he had epilepsy.
Yeah.
And much of the writings in the Quran were written after he had one of these seizures, although I think you mentioned that some of it was probably written previous, and then he made it public after he came out of his seizure, like it was another message from God. But so he's been touched by an angel. Where does he go from here?
Yeah, well, there's an important detail for people who are deniers that he had epilepsy. It's in the literature where when he fell down, when he had his supposed experience with an angel, he fell down and the angel had filled the entire sky and then came down to human size and wiped saliva off his cheek.
Mm-hmm.
Wiped saliva off his cheek. That is a key telling detail because...
Yeah.
People have a seizure, they fall down, and then they tend to swallow their tongue, so saliva spills out of their mouth.
Right, right.
And it could look kind of frothy. So here's a detail, a total giveaway in their own literature. Wipe saliva off his cheek.
And did he at this point name...
Way to get around it. You know, he was an epileptic, by God.
So
in epileptics, this is important to point out. People with epilepsy, with a certain type of epilepsy, temporal lobe epilepsy, which apparently is what he had.
Mm-hmm.
A significant number of them have these experiences where they feel like they're in communion with the divine. And the researchers who look into this and who interview these people as a part of their studies are really stunned by how firmly people cling to that idea that they're somehow mystically connected.
Right.
So, you know, it's nothing unusual for people with temporal lobe epilepsy to have auditory and visual hallucinations and so forth, even olfactory hallucinations.
Now,
so this is what was happening with Muhammad. He misinterpreted it.
And did he know what angel?
Yeah, he said it was Angel Gabriel.
So a Christian angel.
I don't know if he said it at that time, but eventually that became the story.
Right.
So it all starts from there. Now, the problem with Muhammad wasn't that he had epilepsy. A lot of people have epilepsy, even today, although today you can control it with drugs. But he was also a psychopath. This is something that most people don't want to understand, I think. This guy was really dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to determine exactly, you know, when or how his psychopathy formed. But it certainly had to do with the early life experiences. And there was probably more done to him than is ever revealed in the literature. That was a pretty brutal society back then. And child abuse was rampant, just like it is in Muslim countries today. So that always is a factor in the formation of psychopathic personalities, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Child abuse, emotional, physical. So we really don't know everything that went into the formation of his character. But, you know, the later developments where he mass murders people and sends hitmen to kill people who criticize him and so forth, you know, that's got an origin. Normal people don't behave that way. So after, this is starting to emerge, though, after he comes out declaring himself to be a prophet, his psychopathic side, although it's controlled and contained while he's still in Mecca.
Yeah, he had enough. Like, he had enough forethought not to step too far outside the lines at this point because he didn't have. Couldn't. Yeah, he didn't have any following.
Zaid, I mentioned him earlier. One of the four seekers was an In Your Face type of guy, and he got run out of town mainly because he was so uncompromising. Well, Muhammad turned out to be the same way. He was very uncompromising. At first, he didn't attack the Meccan beliefs. He just talked about what he believed to be the truth. And they left him alone. I mean, like, so what? Okay, that's interesting. But then he started attacking the Meccan belief system itself. Then the Meccans became really furious with him. He kept it up, and he was making a handful of converts by that time. And some of them were children of notable Meccans. Others were slaves and, you know, people, freedmen and so forth. There weren't many of them, maybe a couple dozen. So, including Khadija and his wife and his first cousin, Ali. Ali's a very important character. But the Meccans at that point started bristling, and it got to the point where they went to Abu Talib and they told him, you know, tell your nephew to knock it off. And Muhammad didn't knock it off. So it came to the point where the Meccans went to Abu Talib and told him, look, if he doesn't stop, we're going to have to kill him. And they wanted permission, Abu Talib's permission to kill him. This is because in that kind of a society, a tribal society, you know, if you kill somebody, there's reprisal from the offended party, the affected family, which in this case was an entire clan. Now, Mecca at that time was formed of a number of prominent clans that all belonged to the Quraysh tribe. But they all coexisted there in Mecca. Now, if they went ahead and killed Muhammad, then they would have a civil war on their hands because it would be his clan against all the other clans. His clan would be honor-bound to take revenge, you see, and that would create a cycle of violence, and the Meccans didn't want that. So they needed to get permission from Abu Talib to do it, and Abu Talib wouldn't give them permission. So so the tension started rising. And this is in the Quran, you see a lot of entries where, you know, Muhammad repeats what the Meccans are saying about him. Of course, he's attributing all of this to God, you know.
Now, is he writing poetry at this point? And is that part of why they're becoming a little upset is because
of... that's part of it, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He's coming out with these verses claiming they come from God. And the Meccans laugh at him. They ridicule him. And, of course, you ridicule a psychopath, you're gonna pay for it.
And these verses, at this point, are some of the verses that are found in the Quran.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, he's already started his...
superiors to the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
Probably Peter Friedman covered this earlier in one of his broadcasts with you, but there are two divisions of the Quran. There was the Meccan Quran, which tends to be more peaceful, and then the Medina Quran, which, you know, is full of all of these god-awful calls for violence. But while he was in Mecca, he had to be really cautious. You know, he didn't have enough backing to where he could protect himself if it came to violence. So he didn't really unleash the violence until later. But, you know, there was a lot of tension growing, and at some point it became so great that his followers migrated to Abyssinia, which is now Ethiopia. They had to go across the Red Sea. So but his Quran was evolving at that time and developing. He was coming out with more verses all the time and attributing them to God. There's a couple things that should be noted about his Quran style. He uses the God voice. You know, is supposed to be interpreted as God talking. He has to use that device because if he used the word I, you know, God talking in his own voice, it could be confusing to the person listening to the...
And that's really important.
Right?
Yeah, that's really important. And I think people... That's one of the reasons people were getting a little bit upset with him was because of that God voice he's using in his writings, correct?
Oh, yeah. You know, you could imagine it's kind of condescending. You know, here's this guy that's married to a rich woman and doesn't owe much of his status to his own efforts, but to her. Talking down to him as if God's talking. You can imagine people getting pretty worked up over that. And then another feature of the Quran, which is really interesting to know, is that occasionally he gives himself authority to speak in his own voice. And that's preceded by the word say, S-A-Y, say. So he's having God instruct him to say something in his own voice at that point. So then he can talk in his own voice.
Right.
And you see a lot of entries in the Quran like that.
Which that again gives him a lot of power.
Yeah, well, God's authorizing him to talk.
Sure.
So, we're getting into Looney Tune territory here, I tell you. It's unfortunate it turned so violent because that's plaguing the world today. It's totally, a mental, it's a neurological illness which is at work here, along with its psychopathy. And the tensions grow because he won't give any ground whatsoever until later, a little bit later, a couple years later. The pressures get so great that he finally composes a verse that allows the Meccans to worship their three goddesses, Alat, Alausa, and Manat. And this is what's called the Satanic Verses, by the way. Muhammad was under extreme pressure. A lot of his followers, I think it was just after a lot of them migrated to Ethiopia, to Abyssinia, because of the persecution that was taking place. And the persecution being, not nailing people to crosses, but it was mainly the Meccans making people really uncomfortable who were followers of Muhammad. There was some violence against some of the lower order followers, like slaves and so forth. But Muhammad gave them permission at one point to leave. And this is around the time when these Satanic Verses came out. He was under a lot of pressure. And so he came up with this verse that was like a concession to the Meccan belief system. Up until that time, he reviled all of their beliefs totally.
But he was
only one God.
But he was nonviolent.
Anything other than God in God's place was a violation in contempt of God.
But most of what he was writing was still of the nonviolent type of writings.
And,
is that right?
But wait, and was he actually writing this himself?
Or did he have a scribe?
The Quran?
Yeah, didn't he have a scribe?
Well, not at this point, no.
Oh, okay.
No, I don't think so. He was composing. These people had terrific memories because they had to rely on their memories rather than on writing. And so they developed their memories to a great extent, much more than anybody does today. So they could compose verses and then remember them. And then people could hear them, and then after maybe hearing them a few times, repeat them verbatim.
Sure. Just like we got through Dark Ages and everything else, it was all done with stories and
yeah, it was very oral, an oral society.
Yeah, exactly. We better take a really quick break, or we're going to be snowballed here at the end. We're running a little bit late. Our guest is Frank Burley. We're speaking about his book, It's All About Muhammad, A Biography of the World's Most Notorious Prophet. And just a compelling, compelling read. You can find all that information at wethepeopleradio.us, and we'll be right back.
Give a damn's busted. I walk into an empty room. And suddenly my heart goes boom. It's an orchestra of angels. And they're playing with my heart, yeah.
just be having a seizure.
He'd just spitting foam on your chest. So
okay,
Frank,
sorry.
We're gonna move on here. He's in Mecca. He's basically got the powers that be there a little bit angry at him. They want to kill him. They can't kill him. They really don't know what to do with him. So doesn't he kind of start scouting around and kind of looking at other options before he actually left?
Let me fast forward this because, it's a long story, a little bit too long for a radio program.
Yeah, people are going to buy the book when they want the details, but...
they should buy my book because it's all there.
Yes, it is.
Read the book!
he was, the tension kept on building up, and he was... getting threatening, and a lot of his conversations that he has with Meccans turns up in the Quran, which this is, it really shows, it's like a blog, you know? The Quran is like a blog to some extent. And he comments on the happenings of the day in the blog, in the Quran. He was probably the world's first blogger. So you can see things happening and being said to him in Mecca by Meccans, and then he comments on them in the Quran. You know, here, in his scheme of things, right, you know, God dispatches the angel Gabriel, you know, to come to him to whisper these sweet nothings of Quran verses to him, all right? I mean, this is how loony this is. You know, we have this vast universe that now they believe there's something like 20 trillion galaxies out there, and God's going to take time out to whisper all this stuff to Muhammad. I mean, it's totally loony. But, this is what he was pushing, you know. And he had it, by the way, he followed the cosmogony of the day, which held that there were seven levels of heaven, and then above heaven was the throne of God. And he said that the throne of God was above the Kaaba in Mecca. So in his view of things, the throne of God was in geosynchronous orbit around the earth. That's what it amounts to.
Mm-hmm.
So God comes to him via the angel Gabriel and tells him all this stuff. It gets the Meccans really upset. And at some point they decide they needed to kill him, no matter what. Because he was undermining their society, you know. By then he had 100, 150 followers. And he was starting to have influence outside of Mecca. People were coming to him to ask about the religion from out of town. So they decided to kill him. And the way they wanted to do it to avoid a civil war was for a member of each of the clans to participate in the killing. So they would each
have equal guilt
with their sword.
Right.
They would have a shared responsibility for it. So if, Muhammad's clan wanted to take revenge, they'd have to take revenge on everybody. So anyway, Muhammad got wind of it. Yeah, he had his intelligence network set up, and so anything that happened, he got wind of it. He was very good at intelligence gathering, really good. So he escaped. He escaped before they could kill him. They were going to hit him at his home. And what he did was to disguise himself, and then he fled out of town, but to the south. By then, he had already established a foothold in Medina, in Yathrib. People had come to him a couple years earlier about his religion, and he got them to accept it. And they created a base for him in Medina. So when he decided to flee, that's where he was going to go. And he fled with his chief sidekick, Abu Bakr, who eventually became the first caliph of Islam. And they fled south of town, thinking that the Meccans would search the north area, because it was the north exit that takes you to Medina, which was about 200 miles north. And then they stayed in a cave for a few days while the Meccans did a dragnet looking for him.
Yeah, they were after him. They were going to do him in.
Yeah, they were going to kill him. But he was well hidden. Then after 3 days, they left via a very circuitous route, going towards the Red Sea and then up north. And then finally they ended up in Yathrib, now known as Medina. And this is where the violence the violent episodes of Islam begin right there.
And this is where his message of peace and, you know, a peaceful transition to his religion changes, and all of a sudden God starts giving him some different instructions.
Yeah. Yeah, his psychopathy comes to the surface here. It's like lava coming to the surface. You know, it's all hot stuff and it's ready to blow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the first thing he does when he gets to Medina is to create a mosque. This becomes his Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda means base, so it's his base of operations, his headquarters. It's also a prayer area and a recruiting area and a training area and indoctrination center. And it took 7 months to complete it. And when it was completed, then he started attacking Meccan caravans. He may have started even before then, but I think it really took off after the mosque was completed. That was like the first order of business.
And this was with the support of the people in Medina.
Yes, some of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by then maybe he had 300 people who were believers in Medina, but it was a large agricultural valley of about 20,000 people. Half of them were Jewish. The Jews made up half the population, and they were divided into three major tribes. So this is where the violence started. He started raiding Meccan caravans in order to pay them back for rejecting him, and also to try to raise money, because he needed to pay his people off. You know, there were a lot of Meccans that came with him who were now indigent. They had to leave everything behind, and he thought it was only right to go after a Meccan caravan.
And this is when he developed his system of payment as part of the loot. He would divide it up amongst the people that participated, keeping a fair portion for himself. But this was a big incentive for folks to join him, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The promise of booty, you know, was a big recruiter.
Mm-hmm.
He kept 20% for himself. That was his cut.
Right.
And but it became the policy. So that was how he recruited people to go on these raids. At first, it was mainly Meccan expatriates. And there were about like seven raids. Most of them failed. You know, and Muhammad led a few of them, but the others were led by some of his prominent followers. It came to a battle, the Battle of Badr. This is an important battle in the whole story because what happened was that the Meccans had a major caravan coming back from Syria. And the value of all the merchandise and the gold that they were carrying back was something like 50,000 dinars, which are gold coins. And that's a lot of money.
Yeah, they go a long way to helping the cause.
Yeah, absolutely. So he wanted to get his hands on that. He had spies that had told him that it was going north, and but it basically eluded him on the way north, but it was coming back south at some point. So he had spies planted where they would notify him when the caravan was spotted. So when that happened, this was about like 623 A.D., maybe the year after he got to Medina. He formed a small army of 300 men. Many of them were, you know, were from Medina at that point, with the promise of booty. So they went after the caravan. Now, the people in the caravan, when they were in Syria, were notified that Muhammad had been tracking them and stalking them on their trip north, and to beware on the way back because he was going to go after them. So they sent word to Mecca, and the Meccans raised an army of about 1,000 people. And they headed north. And it was a long trip, like it's 200 miles or so, and they're, you know, a heavy-equipped army. It takes some time to get that far. The But Muhammad didn't know it until the last moment. He was going after the caravan, but the caravan already knew what his intentions were. And it was led by one of the major Meccans of the time, Abu Sufyan. He took the caravan towards the Red Sea and then went south along the Red Sea coast. So he was able to avoid Muhammad and his army. But the about the same time, the Meccan army arrived. And this was in a valley called Badr, where there was a, it was an oasis. And caravans would go there. It was like a major crossroads. Because the road there would go south to Mecca or north to Medina or up the Red Sea towards, you know, towards Syria. And this is where the Meccan caravan was supposed to go. That's where Muhammad went. And at the same time he got there, this is about the same time that the Meccan army got there. And so there was a battle. Now, it just so happened that despite the superiority in numbers, the Meccans lost. All of their leadership was killed. Muhammad threw their bodies down a well. He took a lot of captives. Some of them he beheaded. A couple of them were people who had insulted him in Mecca. One man had that he beheaded had thrown camel intestines on his back while he was praying in front of the temple of Mecca at one point. And he never forgave him for that. So he was one of the captives, and Muhammad had him beheaded.
And now was the caravan got away, though, didn't it?
Yeah, the caravan got away. The caravan made a safe passage all the way to Mecca by diverting, you know, from the course that had been...
So as far as booty, there wasn't a lot other than maybe the military hardware they captured from...
Yeah, exactly. Other than that, their encampment, their tents, a lot of their camels, and, you know, the bulk of the army managed to escape. What really made the thing go in Muhammad's direction was another epileptic fit. This is in the literature, and they don't see it this way, but that's exactly what it was. But he starts having a seizure right when the battle lines are forming. Here you've got, on one side, you've got the 300 of Muhammad's people forming their lines. You know, they got bows and arrows and spears and whatnot. And then on the other side, out of arrow range, they got this, you know, distance between themselves, you had the Meccan army. Now, when the battle lines were forming, just prior to the battle, he had a fit. He went up to a little hut that he had erected, and here he's going through his seizure, and Abu Bakr is with him. Now, before his seizure, he's praying for, you know, feverishly to try to stave it off, but it's coming on him really quick. And then he goes into his fit, and it's uncertain how long it lasts, but when he comes out of it, he's all hyped up, you know. He's seen angels. They're up there in the sky. They're coming down on horses, you know, and they're all dressed in white, all of these angels, and they've got their swords raised high. So he goes, runs out of his hut, and he's telling all of his people about the arrival of these angelic reinforcements. So that really, you know, supercharges them. Before then, they were, you know, basically crapping in their pants, you know, because of the numerical superiority of the Meccans. But here, now they had this belief that they were being reinforced by angels. And so, because of that, they were extremely ferocious, and they beat the Meccans.
And you had mentioned in the book that one of the reasons they became so successful in a lot of these battles was they were absolutely fanatical about this new religion, whereas their enemy wasn't. I mean, they weren't, like, totally committed to dying over this thing. I mean, they'd fight, but they didn't have the...
But it wasn't a... They weren't all in, as they
said.
Yeah,
they weren't quite all in like the Islam was.
Hey, you know what? We're way late here. I've been on the little chat room here. We need to take a really quick break, and we're going to come back with Frank Burley, author of It's All About Muhammad, a biography of the world's most notorious prophet. I think you'll like it. You could find us at wethepeopleradio.us for any more information on that, and for the archive of the program, links to the book.
Well.
We have this big battle, Frank, and what were the, I guess, the far-reaching implications of his victory? I mean, it wasn't just he won. It really kind of changed a lot of things, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. He was really pumped up at that point. It was a major victory, and when he returned to Mecca, that's when he started turning on the Jews. And this is really getting into some of the major atrocities that he committed. I should backtrack just a little bit. In that, in Mecca, he composed quite a lot of verses, a lot of chapters, surahs they call them, having to do with the prophets. And his material came from Judaism, these prophet stories primarily.
Right, and he...
But not from the Torah. Not from the first five books of the Bible. This is what most people don't even understand. Probably most scholars are too dense to even understand this, but his influence were the legends of the Jews, the legends of the Jews about the prophets. The legends are like folktale elaborations of the prophet stories found in the Torah. The Torah or Torah, whichever, however it's pronounced. The legends are folktales. The folktales are the major influence for Muhammad for his prophet stories that come out in the Quran. So when he gets to Medina, the bulk of these types of verses and chapters were already composed. So the Jews at first were interested in him because of his claims to be a prophet, and a lot of the rabbis visited him, and they had long discussions. And so he would whip out his prophet stories. The Jews, they listened widely at first, but they realized that his, versions were not from the Torah, so how could they be, given to him by God?
Well, also, Frank, I don't mean to interrupt, but his earlier versions, a lot of the writings were pointed at the Jews to help bring them into his fold, and part of that was when they kneeled down and did their prayers, they faced Jerusalem at first, and that changed, didn't it?
Yeah, he was trying to get them to accept him as their prophet. And so this is why they had a lot of meetings with rabbis and so forth. But they listened to him, and they realized that, you know, that he was coming from a different direction. Not only did they realize that he was using their legends, but he had even modified them. What he did, basically, he created an epic tale about himself as being somebody God talked to. And in this, he was the hero of the story. So all of the modified versions of the prophet stories have him as the center of the story, and basically being repudiated. Prophets were all repudiated by the Jews. This was sort of like the hallmark of being a prophet, a Judaic prophet, is that the Jews rejected them and killed them. This is what he claimed. And so he was being rejected by the Meccans. Therefore, that was proof that he was a prophet, right? So anyway, the Jews of Medina listened to him, and they realized that he was full of baloney. And when he started insisting that they accept him as their prophet, they started ridiculing him. And so same pattern that happened with the Meccans, of him, you know, demanding that they adopt his religion and the resistance that that created, the same pattern was happening now in Medina with the Jews. So when he came back from the Battle of Badr, you know, he's all pumped up. And within a month, he's telling one of the Jewish tribes, the one that was closest to where his mosque was, about a mile or two away. He actually went to their synagogue and told them, look, you know, I'm your prophet whether you accept it or not. I'm the prophet of God, believe it or not. And so he gave them an ultimatum, you know, to bow down to him, basically, and accept him, but they refused. So he came up with a pretext. One of the verses that he came up with after the Battle of Badr authorized him to repudiate a treaty if there was any hint of treason or treachery on the part of the person with whom there was a treaty. This was a real convenient verse. It's in chapter 8, Surah 8. And what happened was that he used that. In fact, he probably composed it on the spot in order to give him a justification for attacking the Jews.
And that became kind of a habit.
Yeah. And it was just a stupid little incident where at the marketplace in front of the Jewish fortress there, they had a plaza, you know, a square, a marketplace. Somebody pinned a skirt up of some believer, one of the believers. She had been there trying to sell some gold trinkets or whatever. And somebody pinned up her skirt so that when she stood up, you know, her butt was exposed. Anyway, it turned into a little fight where one of the Jews got killed, and then the Jews killed the guy that killed the Jew. And so Muhammad used that as a pretext.
Eye for an eye.
But they had repudiated the treaty, showing signs of treachery. And so he attacked them. He surrounded the fortress. He sent out word, you know, that there was booty in the air. So he got a lot of recruits. And about 700 people from Medina joined in the siege. And it lasted for a couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks. Finally, the Jews gave up. Muhammad wanted to behead every one of them. That was his intention. But one of their allies was the leader of one of the major polytheist tribes, the Khazraj. And he confronted Muhammad. In fact, he even grabbed him by his tunic and said, look, leave him alone. They're my allies. You know, you got no right to do this. And Muhammad was just about bursting, his blood vessels. He had when he got really angry, his face turned red and his veins in his forehead throbbed, so he was getting to that point there. But he finally relented and let him go, but they had to leave Yathrib. They had to leave Medina, where they had been for 1,000 years. He forced them out. He let them take their personal possessions, but he stripped them of their weapons. And then when they left, he divided up all of their properties. These were mainly merchants and artisans, as opposed to the other two tribes, which were heavily into Jewish tribes, who had date plantations and barley fields and so forth. So this was the first expulsion of the Jews, the beginning of the end for the Jews of Medina, who made up half the population. He forced them out and took over their properties. It set the pattern.
Yeah,
this
that's
came
the...
only a month after the defeat at Bader of the Meccans.
And that really set the stage for future wealth, future attacks, because that was somewhat profitable for him to take over that fort, take all their land there, and these were large forts. I mean, they had a lot of livestock and stuff they didn't haul off on their camels, so it was pretty profitable for him.
Oh yeah. And I found a picture, a photograph somewhere, I don't know where it is now, but of that fortress, of the Curaça fortress. It was the, not the Curaça, but it was the Canuca Jews. And it's perched on top of the slope that leads up to upper Medina. The Medina's got, is a large valley, but it's, there's a lowland and a highland. And this particular Jewish tribe occupied the very beginnings of the highland. And you can see this fortress, what's left of it, is like, you know, four stories high, is really an imposing-looking structure. These fortresses were very common then because there were a lot of tribal wars, so it was natural for tribes to have some kind of a defense, so they would build these huge fortresses. And then in times of trouble, all of the people of the tribe would go into that one major fortress. You know, they would have access to water and then stores of provisions. So in a siege situation, it was just a matter of waiting them out until they didn't have any more food. So then they either died of starvation or they gave up. That was the idea. So this Jewish tribe finally gave up and agreed to Muhammad's terms. But he wanted to behead them all. That's in the literature. And the only reason he didn't do it is because of the intervention of this particular pagan leader, who was one of their allies. This is a holy man. This is a holy man. This is what the Muslims consider to be a holy man. This is holy behavior. I take a good close look at what's really in their literature. But they don't. You know what? One of the biggest things that people don't realize about Muslims is that most Muslims don't know anything about any of this. It's not just non-Muslims who are ignorant about this, but most Muslims are ignorant about this.
Well, it's kind of like
down their throat.
It seems, you know, like other religions, though they pick up what they want to hear, and then they beat you over the head with it. They don't really look at the whole thing. I was really kind of amazed at the level of information in this book and where it came from. I mean, you're not making it up. I mean, this is all their own writings. And it really makes sense why the things that are happening today are happening.
Yeah, they all follow his example. This is an important concept. Everybody should understand this. The word is called Sunnah, S-U-N-N-A. That is the Arabic word for example or for precedent, something like that. It's got a lot of meanings. But this is all part of Muhammad's Sunnah. Sunnah, his example, the example of his behavior. Now, Muslims are obligated to follow not only the Quran, but Muhammad's Sunnah. This is where the Sunnis get their name from. They are the followers of the ways of Muhammad, which includes all the atrocities that he committed.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was something you'd mentioned, was the difference between the Shia and the Sunnis, and why that is such a major rift. Touch on that a little bit, the difference between what they believe, and it, you know, much of it is around what Muhammad said came from God and what didn't.
Well, you know, actually the Sunnah and Shia split had to do with control of Islam more than dogma, although over time there was some, you know, a bigger rift. But basically the Shia, they believe about Muhammad what the Sunnis believe. I mean, the Sunnis don't dismiss any of the biographical materials about Muhammad that I know of. You know,
but they're
all bona fide Islam for them. But the big split between the Shias and the Sunnis occurred later over the control of Islam after Muhammad died. His first cousin was Ali. Ali was raised in his household. the people who were supporters of Ali believed that he should be the successor to Muhammad after Muhammad died. But it turned out that this clique of Meccans that included Abu Bakr and Uthman and Umar, they were all from different clans. They weren't from Muhammad's clan, but Ali was. He was, a son of Abu Talib. That made him a first cousin of Muhammad. But the after Muhammad's death, it was the Meccan faction that took over. So Abu Bakr became the first caliph, and then came Umar, and then came Uthman. And Ali finally was allowed in, but by then there were civil wars and fighting over who should rule.
Right, so one side believed you had to be a direct descendant of Muhammad. The other side believed in more of a democratic rule. You didn't have to actually be in the bloodline.
Yeah, the bloodline is important for the Shias. Yeah, that's it. That put your finger on it right there. Yeah, that's what they. That's where the split essentially resides in, bloodline. So, and they've been at war ever since. You know.
Right. Right.
I mean, they kill each other off all the time. They do it right now.
Right, and you know that was. I find that interesting because I didn't realize that was really kind of the main focal point of why they don't get along. And when you think about that, really, no matter what we do over there, you're not going to change that thinking. So how are you going to stop these two factions from killing each other when it comes to
control? Well, you don't, actually. I think, you know, what our policy is that we don't know about is to encourage the Shias and the Sunnis to massacre each other. I think that's what's happening now. We, in our bizarre way, even Obama's getting, manipulated into creating this kind of a condition where the Sunnis and the Shias slaughter each other. As long as they're killing each other, maybe they'll leave everybody else alone. But there's a lot of collateral damage, like all these Muslims going into Europe now. But listen, let me be frank with you. The only cure for Islamic terror is to get rid of Islam, period. There's no such a thing as moderate Islam.
No. Although
moderated. It cannot be moderated because it's all about Muhammad.
Right.
It's all about his sunnah. It's all about his claim that God dictated the Quran to him. And this is what Muslims are marinated in from the moment of birth.
Right, right.
So it doesn't matter if a lot of them would not participate in violence, per se, but neither do they deplore it. You don't hear them condemning terrorism. It's very rare that a Muslim will step forward and condemn Islamic terror.
Well, you learn about the things in your book, it starts to make sense of why. Okay, so I told you 2 hours ago, pretty quickly.
Yeah, he did.
I mean, you were worried we wouldn't have enough to talk about. Sure. Okay, so we have you as our hostage for next week as well.
Listen, I hope I haven't bored your audience with
no.
all the detail.
No. We didn't get a chance. Peter Friedman's on the line. He wanted to say hi to you, and we didn't get a chance to do all that because you couldn't hear us part of the time. But next week we're going to start on exactly at noon or 12:05, and we'll get off the ground running.
Terrific.
Thank you very much. Our guest has been Frank Burley. His book, It's All About Muhammad, which is also the name of the website. And you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. See you next week.
Thank you, Frank.
Thanks, Frank. Bye, Peter.